This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Let's say 10 years ago you did something big, maybe even helped save the whole economy, but it was close and controversial. You good with being remembered that way? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 4th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. On the theory that now, with Labor Day behind us and the midterms in front of us, the news is going to start picking up again, getting busy. First of all, were people even paying attention in August? But also, because sometimes it's good to just stop and reflect when you know there is a busier stretch coming, we're going to start today with a look back. A look back at the thing that affects this economy to this very day, the financial crisis and the recession that followed. I was out in Minnesota the other day to talk to Neel Kashkari, now the president of the Minneapolis Fed. But 10 years ago, as we were heading into the worst of the crisis, Lehman Brothers and AIG and all of that, he was the person handling what would become the TARP, the bank bailout for Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Anyway, we got to his office. We chit-chatted for a little bit, got the backstory on a couple of pictures from the George W. Bush White House that he has on his bookshelves, and then we got right to it.
So this is a tricky way to start this interview, but you're a guy who came out of Goldman Sachs. You're from PIMCO. You had your stint in the Treasury. And I'm wondering, when the New York Times runs your obit in 50 years, first sentence is going to be, Neel Kashkari, who led the biggest bailout of banks in American history, died today at the age of 94. You all right with that? I mean, you're a free market guy from way back, and that's your legacy, the TARP and the bailout.
Well, I'm absolutely proud of what we did during the financial crisis. And we were, as you indicated, we were a free market Republican administration that hated the idea of intervening in markets. But it became apparent that we were facing a 1-in-100-year economic crisis and we needed to stabilize the economy. And so although we hated that it got to that point, I'm proud of the actions that we took. I'm proud of the people that I worked with. And I would not turn my back on that experience in any way. I own it. I embrace it. I'm proud of it.
I was actually going to ask this later in the interview, but since you were so forthright in that, I'm going to go with it now. You arguably are the guy whose life was changed the most by that incident, right? Bernanke and Paulson and Geithner, you know, they were at the tops of their careers and they've moved on. They've done other things. Bush and Obama, we know what happened to them. This literally was a life-changing event for you.
It was a life-changing event for me in terms of my career, but it was a much more dramatic life-changing event for millions of Americans who lost their homes. Right? People who lost their jobs. The reason this crisis was so unfair is a lot of people were responsible, bought homes they could afford. Then when the financial crisis turned into the Great Recession and then they lost their jobs, then they lost their homes, it was much more traumatic for them than it was for me.
I want you to start in the spring-ish of 2008. You had called Hank Paulson a couple of years earlier and said, hey, I want to come work at Treasury. And he said, come on down. I want to get things done as Paulson is wont to do. And then things start going south. And he says to you, Neel, I need some help with this. What was the first introduction you had to how bad things were going and the role you were going to play?
It was a slow process. It was summer of 07 when he said, I want you to be in charge of housing for Treasury. And I said, Hank, I don't know anything about housing. But he said, nobody else in Treasury knows anything about housing either. So figure it out. Work with our best economists. Work with people at HUD and the White House. Figure out what's going on in housing and what, if anything, we should do about it. And again, our bias was not to intervene. Our bias was let the markets run their course. That's the way markets are supposed to work. And as we got deeper into it and as time went on, it became more and more and more serious. And I remember it was January of 2008 when there was a phone call that Secretary Paulson and I had with the former chairman, Alan Greenspan. Mm-hmm. And in his very quiet way that Alan Greenspan speaks, I heard him say over the speakerphone, this might be a 1-in-100-year event. that set us back, and that made us think, oh my gosh, Alan Greenspan is saying this might be a 1-in-100-year event. We need to get ready for the worst.
So you guys put together something called the Break the Glass Plan.
That's right.
Which was, in essence, if everything goes to the dogs, as it were, here's what we do. What was in that first plan?
Well, so my colleague Phil Swagel, also a treasurer, and I drafted it. We went through a bunch of different options at a very high level. Everything from putting capital into banks to buying up assets from banks, a range of different options. It was 10 pages, probably 6 or 8 different ideas. No details, just concepts. Just to say, let's have an idea of what we might do if we really needed to do something dramatic. But we also knew that Congress would have to approve any of this. They would have to allocate the dollars for this. So we presented this to Chairman Bernanke and Secretary Paulson. They both said, yes, this looks reasonable.
Wait, back up. Okay. What did Henry Paulson really say the first time you said, Hank, let's talk bailouts?
Well, Hank told us to pull this together. He said, go work on what we will do if the you-know-what really hits the fan.
Right.
And the economy's on the verge of collapse. Pull together some ideas. So it was his idea that we do this work to begin with. We showed it to him. He said, let's go show this to Bernanke. Paulson and Bernanke said, this seems reasonable, but there's no way we can go to Congress right now for this. They'll say, you're crazy. So let's just put it on the shelf, and let's hope we don't need it.
Talk to me about the political environment of the time. I mean, we had a presidential election going on, right? We wound up going from a Republican to a Democrat in the worst crisis in more than a generation. Did you think, you know, Congress and the TARP vote aside, did you think that the politicians had your back?
Oh, no. No. I mean, the leaders, yes, but the rank-and-file politicians didn't. I mean, I was taking the brunt of it because I'd have to go testify in front of Congress many, many times. And generally speaking, the members of Congress were much more deferential and respectful to the Treasury Secretary or the Fed Chair than to some 35-year-old Assistant Secretary.
Right.
And, you know, but the members of Congress were reflecting the anger of their constituents. Their constituents were angry. Their constituents were confused, didn't understand what this crisis was and whose fault it was. And so I got to feel firsthand that anger.
When did you know it was going to be okay? I mean, you had Lehman in September. You had TARP in early October. And then what?
It was a slow burn of the big banks coming under more and more pressure. You know, I had on my at Treasury, I had a Bloomberg screen,
yeah.
And I was watching all the various tickers throughout the day. And, you know, watching the big banks, their stock prices approach zero was an indicator for me that the markets did not believe we'd done enough to stabilize the crisis. So in March of 2009, I think the financial institutions hit a minimum. And then when we got through the stress test in late April, early May of 2009, that's when I said, okay, we've turned the corner. The worst is behind us now. And people know that basically people know that the U.S. government, the U.S. taxpayers, are standing behind the economy. And that was a message that we had to send.
More from Neel Kashkari in the second half of the program on those big banks and our collective economic fate. But a couple of quick present-day indicators before we go on. Oil prices spiked a bit today, over $71 a barrel in New York at one point. Lots of crude and natural gas production being shut in the Gulf of Mexico because of Tropical Storm Gordon. Also, you heard about Amazon today, possibly. It had a $1 trillion market capitalization for about a hot second this morning. The company, by the way, has more than doubled in value over just the past 12 months. Otherwise, in equities at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today, a gentle bend toward the downside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just do it surely ranks among the best slogans for an ad campaign ever. Nike's been making money off it for 30 years and hopes to keep doing the same with ads featuring quarterback Colin Kaepernick. They came out this past weekend with the tagline, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything," the reference there to the social justice protests that Kaepernick started. The ads are not uncontroversial, but as Marketplace's Andy Euler reminds us, sports marketing is big business.
Given Colin Kaepernick's role in the protests that began 2 years ago, Nike must have known that making him the face of its ad campaign would be controversial, says EJ Schultz at Ad Age magazine.
you don't do this without thinking it through. It was pretty obvious the reaction that they were going to get, and lo and behold, they got that reaction.
Since the ad appeared, some people have posted videos of Nike sneakers set on fire or pictures of Nike socks with a logo cut out. On Twitter, the hashtag Nike boycott has been trending. But some big names have tweeted support for Nike's move, including LeBron James, Kevin Durant, and Serena Williams. And ultimately, it's the bottom line that matters more than online reaction. Jessica Ramirez is a retail analyst with Jane Halley and Associates.
Most of consumers that are millennials or Gen Z, when you're trying to target them right now, anything that will attract them is who do you stand behind in a sort of political scene.
Two-thirds of the people who wear Nike are under 35, according to market research firm the NPD Group. But there's more to consider than just who's buying sneakers at the mall, says sports columnist and commentator Terrence Moore.
The NFL actually has a contract with Nike to supply uniforms for all 32 teams and other paraphernalia. Nike is a partner with the NFL.
It's unclear whether Nike gave the league a heads up before the ad dropped. The NFL didn't immediately respond to requests for comment. Nike says it will produce new Kaepernick apparel in the coming months, including shoes and T-shirts. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
While much of the oxygen in Washington today has been sucked up by the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings and by the new Bob Woodward book about the inner workings of the Trump White House, there is work underway elsewhere in the Capitol to respond to China's growing role in financing infrastructure projects in developing economies, Africa in particular. There's a bill that has passed the House and is awaiting action in the Senate to boost international development and infrastructure financing, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains.
Early on in the Trump administration, the White House wanted to cut some programs that encouraged investment in developing countries. Now the administration is backing legislation to increase spending. Kristen Vacasey is a political science professor at the University of Maine.
This is part of a broader sort of geopolitical economic competition as the United States tries to continue to maintain a strong presence in Africa, but also throughout the Indo-Pacific.
Where there are fast-growing economies and where U.S. investment is falling behind. The U.S. tends to spend helping businesses work in other countries, while China pumps money directly from the government into projects like new dams, bridges, and highways. Nirav Patel is president of the Asia Group, which advises U.S. businesses investing in Asia.
When you have effectively a large reserve of money that is effectively unlimited in certain instances, it's difficult for American companies to compete.
But Ray Washburn, president of the government's Overseas Private Investment Corporation, says the U.S. doesn't need to beat China on numbers. His agency is one of several that would see changes under proposed legislation.
You can't look at it, we're going to go spend dollar for dollar with them, because we're not, or project for project with them, because we're not.
Washburn says many of China's investments don't really pan out or don't help the countries where they are made, and that quality investment is much more important than quantity. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Five or so months ago, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg was on Capitol Hill testifying about the Cambridge Analytica scandal, how his company plans to make sure it never happens again, a little bit about Russian interference in the 2016 elections, and in response to a question from Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, who asked how Facebook can still be free, Zuckerberg explained how his company makes money.
Senator, we run ads.
Big tech is back in the senatorial hot seat again tomorrow. Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg, Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, and maybe somebody from Google, it's not quite decided yet, are scheduled to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee about, once again, Russian interference on the 2016 campaign. Questions that will surely veer into why Facebook users wind up seeing some of the ads they see. Georgia Wells covers technology for The Wall Street Journal, including how Facebook's advertising platform can wind up rewarding controversial or sometimes extreme ad content. Georgia, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can I ask a sort of a definitional question first? These extreme messaging ads that you talk about in this piece, what are they and why do they work?
So these are inflammatory and polarizing ads that campaigns are running on Facebook. And what's happening right now is with the midterms in sight, campaign strategists are gearing up to flood Facebook with these ads. And the reason they work is Facebook's cost structure an ability to target really narrow slices of potential voters. Those make Facebook an effective tool for motivating people to kind of act in support of a candidate.
Tell me more about that cost structure, right? Because these ads turn out to be cheaper, right? Even though they work better?
Yeah, exactly. So the way this works is when Facebook's ad auction system shows users ads that are likely to resonate with them, it can end up rewarding attention-grabbing political messages with lower prices. So what's happening here is Facebook predicts how users will respond to an ad, and Facebook gives each ad a relevance score. That relevance score is based on like video views, sales, like other forms of engagement, and a higher relevance score can lower the cost of reaching people.
And thus we get more of those ads because they're cheaper to bang out.
Exactly.
All right. So what do we know then since the last time, you know, thinking about the hearings tomorrow and thinking about the last time that social media was big on Capitol Hill when Zuckerberg went to testify? Do we know more about the decision making process that Facebook is doing in terms of letting us know what's going on and then giving transparency on the platform?
Facebook users now have more tools to see who's behind what they're seeing on Facebook. And so the reason this is that in a bid to boost transparency this year, Facebook changed its platform to make it easier for users to see all the campaigns being run by political advertisers, as well as who paid for them.
The catch, of course, is that we Facebook users have to want to go looking for this information.
I think it's probably safe to assume that few Facebook users in their free time will go scrolling through this. But I think many would argue that this is a win for transparency because there are, you know, privacy groups, journalists, different sorts of consumer rights protection folks who will spend the time going through this.
So there's been a lot of changes, right, since the last time social media was big on the hill with Zuckerberg, as I mentioned. You've written extensively about Jack Dorsey and Twitter and how they make decisions. Do you believe that the panel is going to try to probe how those decisions are made? And are we going to get some transparency into the differing ways that Facebook and Twitter make those decisions? I mean, you wrote the other day that Dorsey himself has weighed in on whether people get their accounts reinstated.
Absolutely. Lawmakers are very, very interested in this issue. When we've seen Jack Dorsey describe some of Twitter's stumbles, he's often been quick to say, oh, Twitter has not communicated these issues. And so I think people really want to know more about how these decisions are being made, particularly if communication is the problem.
Georgia Wells covers technology at The Wall Street Journal. Georgia, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up,
we are safer than we were 10 years ago simply because the biggest banks do have more capital, more of their own skin in the game.
True, but there is more to that sentence. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials ended the day pretty much where they started, 12 points to the downside, 25,952. The S&P 500 lost a 10%, 4 points, 2896. The NASDAQ down about a 0.25%, 18 points, 8,091. Told you about that new Colin Kaepernick ad, which didn't do much for Nike's share. Stock fell a bit more than 3% today. Amazon, as we mentioned, second company to reach $1 trillion in market capitalization. First company to do that, Apple, shares up about a third of 1% today. Tech investors seem a bit spooked ahead of tomorrow's Senate hearing we were talking about. Shares of Facebook down 2.6%. YouTube parent company Alphabet, also Google's parent company, down 1.6%. Twitter off just shy of 1%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal here with today's installment of This is a Global Economy in Ways You Don't Even Think About. The United States has a long history of economic cooperation with Japan. Competition, yes, but also cooperation. Cooperation in cultural affairs as well. Think sushi. over here, and anime, baseball over there, also American convenience stores. Adrian Ma has the story of an iconic Ohio chain that disappeared here decades ago, but is thriving in Japan.
It was 1939 when J.J. Lawson had an idea. He ran a milk business and thought, rather than having this stuff delivered to people's houses, why not open a store and let people come to him? That was the birth of Lawson's Milk Company. Later, he added other staples like eggs and orange juice, and pretty soon Lawson's became what we think of today as a convenience store. Now, maybe you haven't heard of Lawson's, but mention the name to Ohioans of a certain age, and they may even start singing a jingle from an old Lawson's commercial.
Roll on, Big O, get that juice up to Lawson's in 40 hours.
Now one man sleeps while the other man drives on the nonstop Lawson run.
Roger Lumpkin was about 5 years old when his dad started managing a Lawson's franchise in East Cleveland.
I can remember my dad wrapping an apron around me and me putting up the bottled milk jugs that they had. That was a definite memory because the jugs were almost as big as I was.
Lumpkin worked at the store until he went to college. And by that time, Lawson's had grown into hundreds of locations in the Midwest. A place where people could get their meats, cheeses,
potato salad, Twinkies, yogurt, the works.
But then in the 80s, the company was bought out and the stores were renamed Dairy Mart.
And I pretty much thought that was the end of Lawson's.
Except it wasn't. That's because a decade earlier, Lawson's had opened a franchise in Japan. And there, the chain took off.
Lawson から唐揚げくん, 新発売!
It's the number three convenience store after another U.S. import, 7-Eleven, and a homegrown rival called Family Mart. I'm standing inside a Lawson store in Tokyo with Ming Lee. He's a spokesman for the company, and we're staring at rows and rows of freshly made noodles, bento boxes, salads, and dozens of varieties of onigiri, or rice balls.
A Japanese convenience store is very compact, but it offers a huge variety.
But it's not just the food that makes Japanese convenience stores different. Michael Jacobs is a retail analyst at T. Rowe Price based in Tokyo. And he says, walk into just about any Lawson and you can order tickets for movies or flights, make photocopies.
You can also pay your taxes and pay your bills.
Jacob says Lawson is a great example of how foreign brands can adapt to local tastes. In Japan, it's called Lawson, while Ohioans called it Lawson's with an S. But some things are the same. The company colors are blue and white, and the logo is still an old-timey milk can. Across town, I meet 25-year-old Sawa Hino coming out of a Lawson. She says she goes there every day for lunch. I tell her the brand actually started almost 80 years ago as a small dairy store in Ohio.
That's why they have a milk bottle on the logo.
Back in Cleveland, I ask Roger Lumpkin, who's now a videographer, if he misses Lawson's.
Oh, definitely.
And while I can't bring the whole chain back to Ohio, I did bring a little piece of it back. Flavored rice balls from Lawson in Japan.
I'll try the seaweed. Wouldn't be my first choice.
He says it's not how he remembers Lawson's, but it's just cool to see the brand roll on. In Cleveland, I'm Adrian Ma for Marketplace.
A little bit more now from Neil Kashkari, the president of the Minneapolis Fed, but for our purposes, better known as the guy who ran the TARP, the bank bailout, during the financial crisis. So, of course, when I was there last week, we talked about the state of those banks today.
First of all, do you believe we're safer than we were 10 years ago?
We are safer than we were 10 years ago, simply because the biggest banks do have more capital, more of their own skin in the game, to protect taxpayers against their own mistakes than they had before the crisis.
Yeah, but they're also bigger than they were by you know, a factor of a lot, if I could use a technical term, right? Their profits are up. They're doing fine. And yet Congress now is saying, maybe we need to loosen up on the big banks.
No, well, I said they're safer. I didn't mean they're safe enough. We need to go much further. The biggest banks are absolutely still too big to fail. If big banks ran into trouble today, the taxpayers would be on the hook because the administration would be faced with the same choice we were faced with. Let them collapse and potentially bring down the U.S. economy, or use taxpayer money to bail them out. And I think that people end up using taxpayer money to bail them out.
Do you think people know that?
You know, I've been saying it to anybody who will listen, but the challenge is the regulatory winds in this political moment are blowing in the opposite direction. So from my perspective, we just need to keep the message out, keep, you know, pounding this drum, keep putting out the analysis. And if there's a moment where the pendulum swings, then we seize it.
There is more from our Neil Kashkari interview that we are going to play for you, but not till tomorrow because it's only a half an hour broadcast. The crisis next time is what we'll do and where it is going to come from, because it is going to come. This final note on the way out today, just because I like words. The good people at Merriam-Webster have added more than 800 new ones to its dictionary. Here are a couple. TLDR, no, not a word, but work with me here. Hangry is a new one. Goat, also not a word, but, you know, look it up. And finally, fintech. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's off just 12 points today. S&P 500 down a tenth of a percent. That's about 4 points there. NASDAQ down about a quarter percent, 18 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.